I appreciate, my brothers and sisters, very much this opportunity of being with you in this wonderful surrounding at this great university. Somebody has said that the thing is usually not only important for itself alone, it's also important, and sometime a lot more important, for what it's a sign of. And the fact that you're here in this university, or that you're here tonight, is a sign of something very important that's going to happen in your life and in the world. I'd like, more than about anything I can think of tonight, to say something that might be of some benefit or help to you. I don't know that I can do that, but I'd promise you that I would like to. But I thought I'd like to borrow a text tonight from the prophet Amos, who talked quite a lot about famines. And he mentioned two particular kinds. One of them was, he mentioned a famine of bread and a thirst for water. Now that's an experience that we've had throughout the world over the centuries and caused a lot of damage and problems. And when we're a little short of rainfall or some other things, we have some apprehensions about just what's going to happen to us, and we're very interested in that subject. And then we have another one that I suppose is a lot more important, and that is, Amos talked about a famine for hearing the word of the Lord. Now we know something about that, and that's a famine that can take place side by side with plenty, and we remember some great apostasies and some other things where we've had this other kind of a famine. And I thought I'd like to, as a sort of a foundation for what I'd like to say to you, I'd like to tell you about two of the great inventions of the world that have been made to try and offset these two great world experiences. If you had lived in the year 1800 and you owned the most magnificent peach orchard of 100 acres, those peaches would just be valuable to you during the harvest season. And then the French government commissioned one of its greatest scientists, a man by the name of Nicolas Appert, to try and invent some process by which this fruit could be carried over, could be preserved and carried over to later dates. And in the year 1809, and that was the year that Abraham Lincoln was born, Mr. Appert announced to the world this process of putting food in bottles and cans and heating it and sealing it so that it could be carried over beyond the growing season. And the press announced that Mr. Appert had made the seasons stand still. That is, you could now have peaches not only in September, but on Christmas or 10 years down the line or at some other time. Now that's done a great deal to avert this famine for bread and this thirst for water. Now the other invention that took place, and I suppose this could only have taken place by God Himself, when He presented the process of putting ideas down on paper so that they could be carried over from one century to another and from one continent to another, where we could have our ideas beyond the time of their original invention. That is, then, in the darkest apostasy, we could get out the word of the Lord and we could relieve this kind of famine. Let me just tell you of one experience about this. The story is told of two explorers who were working in the then dark continent of Africa, and they were working a couple of hundred miles apart, and one of the explorers wanted to send a message to the other, who was working a long distance away, but he had a native who knew the way and who'd agreed to carry whatever he wanted to send. And so he took out his pen and on some paper made some marks that the native didn't understand on the paper, and then he folded it up and put it in the envelope and gave it to the native. And after a couple or 3 weeks in the jungle, the native appeared at the camp of the explorer and delivered the package that he had been given. The explorer opened the envelope and took out the paper and looked at the marks on the paper. And then, without one single word having been spoken, the man to whom the message was delivered knew where his friend was and what his problems were and what his needs were, and he knew about his health, and he knew every other thing, single thing that he wanted to know about him. just by looking at the marks on the paper. And this miracle so astounded the native that he fell down on his face and worshiped the paper. Now, if I were inclined to worship something other than the one that we're supposed to worship, I think more than anything else I would worship the paper. These papers can be put in books. That is, we can get all of the messages that have been thought by the greatest minds in all of past times and in past ages. When our need takes place, as I say, when we have a famine or a special need, we can get out these special papers and get the message. Now, I like to go down into my wife's fruit room and look at all of the wonderful things that she has prepared in case of this one kind of famine. We have a wonderful rows of peaches and cherries and pears and apricots and all kinds of things in our year's supply. But then we have another year's supply. And I get a greater thrill out of going up into the library and looking at these shelves of books that have the writings of the great men, the inspired writings, the great prophets, the great poets, the great playwrights, the great musicians. I don't spend very much time with them. My wife does, however, but it gives me a great thrill to know that all of these wonderful things are, and that we have a year's supply on our shelves in the library. And I just like to have you think about this sometime as I give you a part of the sales talk, maybe for great ideas, for great human thought. Somebody said this: books are among life's most precious possessions. They are the most remarkable creation of man. Nothing else that man builds ever lasts. Monuments fall, civilizations perish, but books continue. The perusal of a great book is, as it were, an interview with the noblest men of past ages who have written it. Without books, God is silent, justice dormant, philosophy lame. John Milton said, "Books are not dead things, but contain a certain potency of life in them, as active as the soul whose progeny they are. They preserve as in a vial the purest efficacy of the living intellect that bred them." Charles Kingsley said, "There is nothing more wonderful than a book. It may be a message to us from the dead, from human souls we never saw, who lived perhaps thousands of miles away. And yet these little sheets of paper speak to us, arouse us, teach us, open our hearts, and in turn open their hearts to us as brothers." Now, when we have some particular need, we can go into the library where we ought to have a year's supply or we ought to have a lifetime supply of the things that will do for us the things that we need to have done. On many occasions, I have heard President David O. McKay refer to Ralph Waldo Emerson as being the greatest thinker that America had ever produced. And Ralph Waldo Emerson said that his greatest need was for someone or something that could get him to do the thing that he himself knew for sure that he ought to do. Now, we don't have any lack for knowledge. We have lack for motivation. We need somebody to get us to do the thing that we ought to do. Someone once said about salesmen, he said, "There are no lazy salesmen. They're just salesmen that lack motivation. They're just salesmen that don't have the right kind of impulses." Now, we can, through books, through great ideas, through the great motivations, we can get the ideas to help us to do the thing that we ought to do. I heard Theodore Burton say a little while ago that 2% of the people of the church do all of the genealogical work of the church. 2% do the work. Then there's 8% that bear their testimonies and do the praying and talking about it. And then there's 90% that do nothing at all. Now, if we could raise ourselves up into this 2%, now that doesn't just apply to genealogical work, it applies to a lot of other things. See, we wrestle all of our lifetime with this great power of inertia. The There's a great power in the world that tends to just keep everything and everybody inert. We lack the inherent power to move. I mean, some things do. The stone lies on the mountainside for 1,000 years. Now, if you roll it over the side, it'll roll down the edge, but as soon as it's exhausted its momentum, it comes to rest. An automobile needs to be constantly refueled as it drives down the highway or it runs out of gas. People, without continual booster shots, we become stale. We go stale. We quit. We become dropouts. We have great ideas and great impulses, but sometimes we don't follow through. We shoot if I had a powerful rifle, I could shoot a bullet through the most powerful rifle, and no matter how far it goes, it eventually comes to a standstill. Now, if we have some method of giving ourselves booster shots, before we get away from this stone on the mountainside, I'd like to repeat a poem that I picked up someplace. I like great poetry, and this is a great one, and so I memorized it so I could say it to you down here this afternoon, and this is what it said. I don't know who wrote this. I don't think anybody at the BYU did, but that might have been, but this is what he said. I wish I was a little rock a-sittin' on the hill, a-doin' nothing all day long except just sitting still. I wouldn't eat, I wouldn't sleep, I wouldn't even wash. I'd sit and sit 1,000 years and rest myself, by gosh. Now, isn't that an inspiring poem? Doesn't that just get you all excited and make you want to do a lot of things? I was down in Kentucky some time ago when they run the Kentucky Derby, and I always like to investigate success. When somebody does something, I like to, that's worthwhile, I like to know about it, and I knew I was going to come down here to BYU sometime, and I thought you'd like to report to me to report to you any interesting thing that I saw, and I was very impressed how one jockey could get his horse to run around that racetrack faster than anybody else could get his horse to do it. And I knew you'd want to know the secret of it, so I checked into it, and I found an interesting thing. He did it by reciting poetry to the horse. I'd never heard of that system before, and I knew you'd want to know what the poem was, and I was curious to know what the poem was, and so I have a copy that I'm prepared to give to the president after this meeting. But this is what this successful jockey said to the horse. He said, "Roses are red and violets are blue, and horses that lose are made into glue." And that so inspired that horse that he won the race. Now, the Lord has some glue poems for this 80 or 90% that where we don't do the thing that we ought to. We think of the Savior of the world as a rather meek, pleasant, and he was, all of these things that I'm thinking about and that you're thinking about, but he was a little bit serious about some things. When we didn't get ourselves in proper motivation, you remember the unprofitable servant who didn't magnify his stewardship. This is what the master said to him, or the unprofitable servant said, "I was afraid, so I hid my talent in the ground." The Lord said to him, "Thou wicked and slothful servant." And then he said to those that are with him, "Take the talent away from him and give it to him that has 10 talents, and cast the unprofitable servant into outer darkness, and there shall be weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth." Now, you try to think of anything more serious than that. I mean, more harsh maybe than that. You remember he said he's going to divide all of us into two groups when he comes again. The ones over here on the right hand, he's going to say to them, "Come ye blessed of my Father. Enter into the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." Now that's wonderful. That's a great idea. But to those on his left hand, he's going to say, "Depart from me, ye cursed, into everlasting fire. I never knew you." Now maybe they're the ones that don't get the job done. Now, if we have some ideas about how we can do it, and I'd like to take you for a few minutes and to think about these great ideas, these great human thoughts that have been put down for our benefit, so that we can go back and read the philosophy of Enoch or Adam or the Son of God, or we can live with Abraham, we can go up onto the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus as he was transfigured and talked with Moses and Elias before Peter, James, and John, we can have all of these great experiences out of the past and bring them down and put them right on the piston head to produce for us a good life. And I just like to say, in my year's supply or my lifetime supply, the greatest possession that I have in the world is made up of 25 notebooks. They're just regular 8.5 by 11 inch three-ring binders with about 300 pages in each one. That'd be 7,500 pages of ideas. Victor Hugo said one time that the most powerful thing in the world is an idea whose time has come. And an idea's time comes when we're able to get a harness on it so that we can get it to work for us. Now, I'm not interested in equally in all ideas. Some ideas are better than others. That is, even the Bible itself. I'm not interested in everything or very interested in everything that's in the Bible. For example, the other night I heard somebody read about the Moses' instruction to the Israelites about how to cure leprosy. Well, it just happens at the moment that I'm not interested in curing leprosy. I just don't happen to have any leprosy at the moment. Now, if somebody put a paragraph in there about a deteriorating retina, I'd gobble that up in great shape, but leprosy I'm not interested in. Or I read another idea about Zedekiah went out and killed 60 people. And I tried to figure every way I could how I could use that skill of his to help my own personal interest. And I didn't come up with any answers. So I passed that over. I just crossed that off. And then I come to this little nugget, this little thing that sends a chill up and down my back. This thing that gives me an ambition that I'd like to do something. Then I take that out and put it in my idea treasury and then I go back and memorize it. And I'd like to tell you a great idea, and I've mentioned this before, and I'll be very brief with it, but it's one of the great ideas that I know about. Many years ago, I heard Adam S. Benyon give a talk on the value of great literature. That is, what are the value of great ideas, of great human thought? Now, that's an idea that you can sell to anybody, except that most people lose the benefit by saying, but I don't have time to read. Now, we have time for everything else, but we don't have time to read, and we're pretty well forgetting how to read effectively. But Dr. Benyon tried to get around this idea by saying, supposing that you were going to be a prisoner in a Japanese concentration camp for the next 10 years. That is, this was back at the end of the war. And supposing that you didn't have anything to do but to read. Now, you go into a concentration camp where all reading is taken away from you for a little while, and you get pretty hungry for great ideas. So he said, if you could take with you into this concentration camp the works of any 10 authors, which would you take and what would you expect to get out of it? Now, at that time, I was teaching a class in salesmanship. And I decided that I would like to reread the Bible with the idea of getting out of it as salesmanship. Now, the Bible is the world's first book of religion. It's the world's first book of knowledge. It's the world's first book of poetry. It's the world's first book of history. But it's the world's first book of business success. It's the world's finest sales manual. That is, the very best way that has ever been discovered to be a good salesman is to be a good man. The very best way that has ever been discovered to be a good attorney or a good husband is just to be a great human being, just to have these great qualities of character and personality that are talked about in the Holy Scripture that the Lord would like to have us develop. And I decided to read the Bible with the idea of getting out of it as salesmanship. Now, when you read the Bible, to get out of it as theology, it's a quite a different book than when you get it when you want its literature or when you want its salesmanship. And I had a thrilling experience with the Bible. Let me give you just one sales method. Now, I'm talking about these great principles of industry and enthusiasm and character and faith that are the fundamental virtues of all business success. But the methods are a little on a lower level than that. But let me just give you one of these others. As Moses was about to start across the desert with this great group of Egyptian slaves, he needed somebody who knew the desert to go with them to be their guide. And there's a man on the edge of the desert by the name of Hobab who lived on the edge of the desert that Moses had chosen and wanted to go with them, but Hobab didn't want to go. So it was Moses' job to try to persuade him to go and be their guide in the wilderness. And he approached him, and this is what he said to him. This wasn't a very good approach, because it didn't work. I mean, you tell whether it's good or not, whether it works or not, I suppose. And this is what Moses said to Hobab. He said, "Hobab, come with us, and we will do thee good." And Hobab said, "I will not go." See, we make a lot of approaches like that in the church. You come to church, and we'll do you good. That is, it'll be nice for you to associate with good people like us. Now, that might be a pretty good idea, but it just doesn't work is the only trouble. I mean, nobody wants somebody to do him good. Too many people have had somebody do him good under those circumstances. But Moses needed Hobab, and so he went back and tried again. This time he strengthened his appeal. This time he said, "Hobab, come with us, that thou mayest be as eyes to us in the wilderness." Now, that's a completely different idea. He didn't say, "We'll do you good." He said, "Look, Hobab, if you let us get out there in the desert by ourselves without a competent guide, we'll probably get lost, and we'll all starve to death, and this whole work of the Lord is going to come to nothing because we don't have somebody to lead us. You come and be our guide. You come and show us which way to go." Now, we sometimes make that kind of an appeal in the church. We say, "Look, Bill, we don't have anybody who can teach this class like you can. You come and show us the way. You come and be our guide in the wilderness." Now, that's a service appeal. See, has a lot more power in it. And before Moses got through with that appeal, Hobab had on his hat and he was ready to go. Anyway, I had a thrilling experience with the Bible I'd like to tell you about, but there isn't time. I've written quite a little bit on the salesmanship of the Bible. Then I decided that I'd like to take up Shakespeare. Now, Shakespeare comes pretty near the top of most people's list of great ideas, I suppose, and so I decided to read every word that Shakespeare ever wrote. That is, I decided to rethink every idea that Shakespeare ever thought, to run through my brain every idea that ever went through his brain. Now, I got started, and I had a pretty hard time. He wrote a long time ago, and a lot of things I didn't understand, and I had to look it up and go back and reread it, and I'm letting my work kind of drag a little bit, and I decided to discard the idea a lot of times, but I made myself a promise, and I don't like to disappoint myself, so I'd go back, but finally the clouds began to part, and a little bit of the sunshine began to come through, and I had a tremendous experience with Shakespeare. Let me just give you one idea. When Henry V was the King of England, France was one of their subject nations, and Henry had a little trouble with some of these Frenchmen, and he took a little army and went across the Channel to put these Frenchmen in their places, and the job was a little bigger than he had expected, and he was delayed a little bit, and then an early winter cut off their retreat, and they were forced to spend the winter near this little French village of Agincourt. And there was a heavy winter, and a lot of them died, and they didn't have supplies, and they were in a hostile territory, and the next spring, when they might have expected to get on their way, they found themselves surrounded by a great army of 60,000 well-fed, well-trained, well-horsed, well-armored Frenchmen, intent on wiping out the British and, of course, get their freedom. Now, what would you do if you were met with a circumstance like this? What do you do when things get a little tough and the lessons get harder, the finances get low? What do you do? Well, one thing to do is to quit. You can just give it all up, but that isn't what Henry did. He wasn't that kind of a person. He got his people together to talk it over with him, and I guess you'd call this, he gave them a little pep talk, I suppose. And this is what he said to the soldier. This is a part of the things that he said before the Battle of Agincourt. That is, this is Shakespeare edited by Brother Sill. That is, when Shakespeare doesn't say what I think he ought to do, I just cross off what he says and write in what I think. That is, I don't read Shakespeare to please Shakespeare. I read Shakespeare to please me. And if it doesn't please me, then I change it. I mean, if Shakespeare makes a mistake, I can't help that. I just correct it. And then. But this is what he said. "Once more into the breach, dear friends. Once more the blast of war blows in our ears. The French are bravely in their battle set and will with all expedience charge upon us. 'Tis fearful odds. There's 5 to 1. Besides, they are all fresh. 'Tis true there is great danger. The greater, therefore, must our courage be. Then he said, O God of battles, steel my soldiers' hearts. Possess them not with fear. Princes all, God be with you. We may never meet again till we shall meet in heaven. God's arm strikes with us. All things are ready if our minds be so. Perish the man whose mind is backward now. Then he said, on, ye noble English. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slips, straining upon the start. The prey's afoot. Follow your spirit. I'll to my task. There's work to be done and throats to be cut. Now, he didn't say this is going to be an easy job. He said, we'll probably none of us live till sundown. We'll never meet again till we shall meet in heaven. But just notice some of these great lines. God's arm strikes with us. Or think about this one. All things are ready if our minds be so. See, if we just make up our minds, then we don't have much of anything else to do. If we just get our minds made up. Now, sometimes we can't do that. I heard of a psychiatrist who said to a mental patient, do you ever have any trouble making up your mind? And the mental patient said, well, yes and no. Now, we don't get very far under those circumstances, but you students, if you'd like to get great grades, just make up your minds about it. Just make a program and decide that you're going to stick to it. One of Henry's soldiers came up to him after this talk the general that the king had given, and he said, look, king, we've got a million Englishmen over across the channel that are right now asleep in bed. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we had them over here to help us with these 60,000 Frenchmen? Henry got after him and said, look, that would dilute our honor. What honor would there be in a million Englishmen whipping 60,000 Frenchmen? And I said, if 12,000 weak, sick foot soldiers can whip 60,000 well-horsed, well-trained, well-armored soldiers, that's honor. And he didn't say this in these words, but he said, if a million men should come across the channel, we'd send them back. We want to whip these Frenchmen by ourselves. And he said, as I say, I'm putting in some words here, but he said, God's to this soldier, this backward-thinking soldier, he said, God's will, my liege, that you and I alone, without more help, could fight this royal battle. That is, he said, the two of us alone could whip these 60,000 Frenchmen. Now, that may not be very good judgment, but that's courage. And that's what most of us need more than about any other thing. It just happened that the Battle of Agincourt was fought on St. Crispin's Day. Crispin had been a martyr to the church. He was a shoemaker who'd been killed for the church a few hundred years before, and they had the feast of St. Crispin, and Henry said to his soldiers, this day is called the Feast of Crispin, and he who survives this day and comes safe home will in time to come stand on tiptoe when this day is named. And those gentlemen in England now asleep in bed will think themselves accursed. They were not here to fight with us on this St. Crispin's Day. See, when we get an idea in our mind, just think of these poor, unfortunate people over in England who are asleep in a nice warm bed, while we have the greater privilege of giving our lives for England over at Agincourt. Now, when we can think like that, then we don't have very much problem with the victory. Incidentally, the British won the Battle of Agincourt. You've seen this in the movies. They drove stakes in the ground to stop these horses, and then these foot soldiers stood behind and shot these out of the English longbow, these arrows over among the French and knocked their horses down and got these men heavily armored down in the mud where they couldn't get up, and then they went around with their spears and gave them some individual attention while they were lying there in the ground. And at least the French won the battle of, or the English won the Battle of Agincourt. Now, I'll come back to that in a minute, but one of my heroes for many years was the famous sports writer of a long time ago that some of you wouldn't remember, by the name of Grantland Rice. For 50 years, Grantland Rice went around the country following the great champions of sport to find out what it was that made men champions in athletics. And then he isolated these traits and wrote poems about them. One of them he entitled Courage. He wrote 700 of these poems. This is a pretty good thing to run these things through one's mind, because then these can transform your mind. This one entitled Courage, this is what he said. I'd like to think that I can look at death and smile and say, all I have left now is my final breath. Take that away, and you must either leave me dust or dreams or in far flight, the soul that wanders where the stardust streams through endless night. But, said he, I'd rather think that I can look at life with this to say, send what you will of struggle or of strife, blue skies or gray, I'll stand against the final charge of hate by peak and pit, and nothing in the steel-clad fist of fate can make me quit. That is, he wasn't about to become a dropout. Grantland Rice wasn't a quitter. Now see, if I can get that spirit inside of me, I mean assuming this is one of the qualities that I would like to develop. Ernest Henley, you may remember, was a hopeless cripple when he wrote Invictus and said, out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeoning of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this veil of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Or suppose you try to figure out what Solomon had in mind when he said, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. See, if we can get the right kind of ideas in our brains. All right? Any of you who are interested in going up a little few notches in the scale, think of this one entitled The Champion. What would this do to somebody if he really got it in there, stamped in the brain cells in the right way? He said the average runner sprints until the breath in him is gone, but the champion has the iron will that makes him carry on. For rest the average runner begs when limp his muscles grow, but the champion runs on leaden legs. His spirit makes them go. The average man's complacent when he's done his best to score, but the champion does his best, and then he does a little more. See, if you want to be a champion, there's the recipe. All you need to do is just get that in there and follow it. I understand that there are quite a number of missionaries in this group tonight. You're going out for 2 years into the mission field. What are you going to do about it? But suppose you take with you this little poem entitled Conquest that you're going to recite 2 years later when you come home. This is what it said. 2 years ago, the stubble leered at him, and great gray boulders stood to bar the way. Old dying trees with twisted trunk and limb snarled in defiance like wild beasts at bay. Others from time to time had scanned the space, but had not dared the struggle to begin. So tangled were the growth that ruled the place, that few who passed it by would venture in. And then he came and vowed to clear the land. With drag and chain he slowly inched his way. That night some new attack he sat and planned. At dawn, undaunted, he resumed the fray. I saw him once in battle, and I thought his courage and his patience all in vain. Today I passed the field whereon he fought, and it was flaming gold with ripening grain. Now whether the debris you're trying to clear away is rocks and tree trunks and other things, or whether it's sins and weaknesses or whatever, it doesn't make very much difference if we just make up our mind. And then if we don't allow too many exceptions, that is, if we just do the thing that we know we ought to do. Anyway, I got off of Shakespeare. After I'd finished Shakespeare, I read 28 volumes of Elbert Hubbard, and I love Elbert Hubbard. And then I read the Harvard classics. You remember back many years ago, the then president of Harvard got a lot of groups together to get the greatest ideas that had ever been thought or spoken in the world, so that I can go through. Now, I read very slowly and maybe not very comprehendingly, but I always read with my pen. I mark these ideas. I mean, these ideas that they only need to have one qualification, and that is that they do something for me. I'm trying to find these ideas that'll get me going. Then after that, I read the complete works of Ralph Waldo Emerson. I said, you remember a few minutes ago that President McKay had said that Ralph Waldo Emerson was the greatest thinker that America had ever produced. Now, if this doesn't give you a thrill, I don't know how to do it. If you just think of the idea that I can run through my little weak brain, every idea that went through the brain of the greatest thinker that America had ever produced. See, if you read the ideas that were written by Apostle Paul or Emerson or Shakespeare or Jesus of Nazareth or whoever, you get enough of those ideas in your brain will start responding as their brains did. All right, how'd you like to be a great person? How'd you like to be a great missionary? How'd you like to be a great human being? Just think the right kind of thoughts. Now we can get them out of books. You remember something that was very significant in the history of the church that I've been thinking about since I can't read anymore. I can't see a songbook, and I listen to you sing these beautiful hymns and these stirring national anthem or some other patriotic songs or these things that send chills up and down your back, and it isn't just necessarily what you think. At President Eisenhower's first inaugural, he said the great driving forces of the world are not intellectual completely, but emotional. See how we feel about things. Now, there are certain ideas that make us feel in a certain way that we'd like to feel. Now, we ought to have a selection of our own. I miss a great deal that I can't pick up this songbook and read it. I sit by a lot of people, and they can't either, because I hear them say, dumdy, dumdy, dumdy. I mean, they know the music, but they can't know the words. And I just like to suggest that you might pick out 100 of the great hymns or the great songs about any other thing or the great poems, the great literature of the world, and get it stamped into your mind. I walk to work every morning for 3.5 miles, which gives me about an hour I don't have anything to do. And if I want to build spirituality or faith, I get those ideas and run them through my brain. Let me just give you one. O God, I thank Thee for each sight of beauty that Thy hand doth give, for sunny sky and air and light. O God, I thank Thee that I live, that life I consecrate to Thee, and ever as the day is born, on wings of joy my soul doth flee to thank Thee for another morn. Another morn in which to cast some silent deed of love abroad, that greatening as it journeys past may do some earnest work for God. All right, to memorize the great hymns. I had an interesting experience just this morning. I had occasion the other day to want to tell somebody about the O My Father. And I found out that I didn't know. After singing O My Father for 65 or 70 years, I still didn't know the words O My Father. Now, if I'd have taken off a few minutes back there and learned the words, I think I learned them now, except they're... Well, maybe I'll just show off here a little bit. I'll try to recite it to you. Now, if I break down in the middle, there are a couple of points that I'm not quite sure on yet, but now I'm talking about this because somebody said the poets stand next to the prophets in their ability to lift us up. Now, I've never heard of Eliza R. Snow, for example, being sustained as a prophet, seer, and revelator. And yet she wrote, O My Father. And there's a lot of theology, there's a lot of doctrine that you can't find in any scripture, so far as I know. But this is what she said, if I'm successful in getting past these two places. O My Father, Thou that dwellest in that high and glorious place, when shall I regain Thy presence and again behold Thy face? In Thy holy habitation did my spirit once reside? In my first primeval childhood was I nurtured by Thy side. For a wise and glorious purpose Thou hast placed me here on earth and withheld the recollection of my former friends and birth. Yet oft times a secret something whispers you're a stranger here, and I felt that I had wandered from a more exalted sphere. I had learned to call Thee Father through Thy Spirit from on high, but until the key of knowledge was restored, I knew not why. In the heavens are parents single? No, the thought makes reason stare. Truth is reason, truth eternal, tells me I've a mother there. When I leave this frail existence, when I lay this mortal by, Father, Mother, may I meet You in Your royal courts on high. When at length, when I've completed all You sent me forth to do, with Your mutual approbation, let me come and dwell with You. Now, if you say those great words, it's quite different than humming the tune and say, dum-dee-dum-dee-dum-dee is for the words. You get the words, and so that every time they pass through your mind, you know just exactly what you're talking about. Now, I'd like to close with another great poem, and if I were going to try to put a title on what I've tried to say to you, it would be The Great Literature and the Good Life. I mean, we can use these great ideas that are preserved for us in the books. Now, we need the peaches and the bottles and the plums and the apricots that go in the bottles. But we need these great ideas of faith and ideas of courage and ideas of religion and ideas of patriotism and other things that we can get out of our books. John Gillespie McGee was an American fighter pilot connected with the Royal Canadian Air Force who was shot down over London in the Battle for Britain in the first part of the Second World War. Before going into the service, John Gillespie McGee had done the usual things that 17-year-olds do. And then after his basic training had been completed, for the first time he felt in his hands the controls of these powerful engines, capable of sending this aircraft through space at stupendous speeds. And then feeling the exhilaration that came from doing well his part of the work of the world, he wrote his great poem entitled High Flight, which is now found in the Library of Congress under the title of Poems of Faith and Freedom. Now, I share this with you tonight because you're also engaged in the greatest high flight ever known in the world. John Gillespie McGee said, "Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the sky on laughter's silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed to join the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence hovering there. I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the wind-swept heights with easy grace, where never lark nor even eagle flew. And while with silent, lifting mind I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God." Now, that's the purpose of our lives, my brothers and sisters. The greatest good fortune in the life of any one of you is that every one of us in this building and out of this building were created in God's own image. And we've been endowed with a set of His attributes and potentialities. And we've inherited His destiny. The Lord Himself said, "Ye are gods, and all of you are children of the Most High." And may the Lord bless you, my brothers and sisters who are attending or not attending this great university. But as you go forward to take up your share of the work of the world or the work of the Lord, may His Spirit be with you to inspire and direct you in all of the things that you do. I sincerely pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.